My nominee for Tweet of the Year, Michigan. Is there anyone else you'd like little brother to beat for you? It doesn't get much better than that. Congratulations, Spartans. Saturday's last-minute win was as good as it gets. In current sports, Al Martin joins me at the end of the hour here to relive the victory over the Buckeyes for a little bit and to anticipate Senior Day against Penn State this Saturday at Spartan Stadium. Sam Singh is our first guest here this morning. Where did you watch the game, and how did you celebrate?
My wife and I and a couple other couples watched the game at Reno's, and I got to tell you, it was an intense place, and people were on pins and needles all the way to that final kick, but it was an amazing result, and you know, we survived for another day, and we've got Penn State to wrap it up, and if we play strong, we'll go to the Big Ten Championships.
I think you were in town in 98, but I mean, I invoked the Spartan win in Columbus in 98, and Ohio State was number one in the country.
Sure.
Then, and we upset them in Columbus, and I tried to get some good vibes going here on Friday, thinking that hey, we can do this.
Absolutely.
You know, we can do this, and we did it, so it was good fun. Well, it is a Monday of Thanksgiving week. Votes are approaching that will determine the future of Michigan energy policies. For months, legislators have been debating energy efficiency, renewables, and consumer choice in the electric market. Sam Singh is playing a key role in the energy legislation being considered in the Michigan House of Representatives as a member of that body's Energy Policy Committee. Sam is playing a key role in proposals that will soon be subject to more deliberation. The freshman Democrat and former East Lansing City Councilman and Mayor says he's pleased with the measures currently being debated on the House floor. We welcome Sam Singh back to Current State officially. You told me late last week that you and the other Democrats are generally pleased with the proposals that came out of your committee, House Energy Policy, a couple of weeks ago that will be taken up more seriously here by the full House soon. The Republicans obviously enjoy a majority on all these committees now. Is the House about to debate a measure that is really a bipartisan thing?
Well, I hope so. Technically, I'm not on the committee, though I've spent so much time on it, I feel like I'm on the committee itself. But we've been taking a look at revisions to a 2008 act that was a bipartisan act that helped create our current energy system that we have right now with a 10% choice cap, 10% renewable energy, as well as a 1% a year energy efficiency mandate. And so as we've been having those conversations, House Democrats and House Republicans have been trying to see if there's a way that we can build that same coalition that was here in 2008 and pass something. And I was pleased that at least on the committee level, it came out of the committee with significant support with both Republican and Democratic supporters.
And you've been working with Eric Nesbitt on this pretty closely. Is that it?
I have for the last few weeks. Eric Nesbitt and I are close. As you know, Eric is the floor leader for the Republicans. I'm the floor leader for the Democrats. And so we often will talk about things that are coming up on the floor and negotiate a number of items. And so I was pleased to join him and my colleague Bill Lavoie, who's the vice chair of the Energy Policy Committee, to have these conversations. And I'm pleased with where we're at. I will tell you, though, not all my colleagues are satisfied with where we're at. I know there's some environmental groups that have been critical of where we're at, but I think knowing the environment that we are in, with Republicans running, both the House, Senate, and the governorship, that I think we're in a good place to find common ground with our Republican colleagues.
Well, let's talk a little bit about each of the big pieces of these energy bills. And there are two in the House and two in the Senate. In the House, it's HB 4297 and 4298. I know one big piece is energy efficiency. How would these bills, broadly speaking, in layperson's terms, if possible, how would these bills address energy efficiency?
One of the great hallmarks of the 2008 law was this 1% a year requiring the public utilities that we work with, the DTEs of the world, the Consumers Energy, also our BWL, to work on energy efficiency. So they work with the homeowner to make their home more energy efficient. They'll work with the business to make it more energy efficient. And right now they're mandated to do 1%. In the conversations we've been having right now, a critical, you know, stumbling block for my colleagues on the other side of the aisle is mandates on business. And so what we've been discussing is more incentive-based, is that you could work towards an incentive that a utility won't see any benefit if they don't reach a minimum of 1%. So they'll actually begin to see some incentive financially to have a 1%. But we also then raise that all the way up to 3%. I had introduced a bill to try to get it to 2%. And so right now, I think the compromise is that there's a range from 1% to 3%. You know, it's not a mandate as the Democrats would want, but it's a financial incentive program that I think gets us to the same place. And so that's why I was pleased with where we've gone in energy efficiency. And just so far since 2009 and since we've enacted this legislation, we've actually saved $3.4 billion through energy efficiency. And the Public Service Commission, who does the research on this, says for every dollar that we invest in energy efficiency, the consumer itself saves anywhere from $3 to $4 in unused energy costs. Mm. And so this is a really big victory for us. It's something that the governor has talked very extensively about in his goals, is to try to reduce energy waste, as he calls it.
State Rep. Sam Singh of East Lansing is our guest here on WKAR's Current State. Is the 1% to 3% range, that would apply to businesses only?
So it applies to the utility themselves. It gives them a financial incentive as they hit these benchmarks to do more energy efficiency. And so it does help the residential customer, and it also helps the business customer. But in the end, it's not an incentive for the individual at their homes. It's an incentive to move the utility itself to doing more of these programs. Because the long-term goal is, if we can reduce the amount of energy that we use, we don't have to be building more plants. And those are highly intensive, highly costly. And so if we can reduce our energy by having more efficient homes, by having more efficient businesses, we can save a lot of money long-term.
Another big piece of these is renewables. Describe what's in play there.
So again, right now we have a 10% renewable standard. One of the conversations early on by my Republican colleagues was to completely eliminate that. I thought that that was not the most responsible way, but I was pleased that I think as Republicans took a look at it, they saw that this would have a significant impact. There's a number of contracts that are currently in place right now with utilities to get to this 10% renewable standard. As the president and the EPA have rolled out their clean energy plan, it is going to require our utilities to do more in renewable because we have to get off of our coal-based power plants. And so what this does basically is continue that 10% that we have currently right now. And there is some language there that if you get a combination of energy efficiency as well as renewables, that the goal is to hit at least the minimum that the governor had asked for, which was 30% by 2025. The governor also suggested that we could go as high as 40%. And so my hope is that we'll see through this language a combination of more renewables as well as more energy efficiency, not by a mandate, but by incentives.
Mm. And right now, 10% of Michigan electricity customers can choose what utility they buy their juice from. Talk to us about this market choice piece.
Yeah, that was part of a compromise in 2008. We had deregulated our utility system back in the early 2000s. And as part of coming back to a more regulated system, the debate at that time was to, and the compromise at that time was to provide 10% energy choice. And we're currently at that 10%. There are a number of businesses that are in the queue waiting to get lined up. So if a business decides to leave the energy choice program, then the next business sort of comes in. Democrats had been pushing forward to reduce that 10% to a smaller number because we do believe having a fully regulated system is ideal. But based on the conversations and having to compromise in this type of environment, currently right now the legislation still keeps the 10% cap, and it keeps those organizations and businesses that are in that queue still in lineup for that energy choice. So to some degree, you're not going to see a significant change if the bills that are currently being debated on the House floor more move forward, I think we'll see a 10% choice remaining there. And that's the compromise that I think many of us have had to make to kind of move this process forward.
Democratic State Rep Sam Singh of East Lansing, 69th District, is our guest here on WKAR's Current State. One more question involving renewables. Was there interest in the legislature in lowering that 10%, or is everybody on both sides of the aisle generally content with 10%, or was there pressure to lower that?
There was actually a proposal on the Senate side that actually repealed the entire renewable energy mandate. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to go back to keeping a status quo, but then putting kind of incentive language in, I don't want to get too technical with your listeners, but there'll be an IRP planning process that the Public Service Commission will go into. And so if you provide incentives for the utilities, I think you can get more renewables. They're going to be mandated to some degree to do it anyways by the new EPA rules and regulations. And so I'm comfortable moving forward, but I can tell you I've got a number of Democratic colleagues as well as, you know, some environmental organizations who want this legislation to go further than it did.
There is a torrent of TV advertising flooding the state, and these are from the Citizens for Michigan's Energy Future. I'd like to listen to one of these. They're going to be real familiar to anyone who watches any television at all, and have you deconstruct it for us here. Let's listen.
Time is ticking. First, we found out 9 Michigan power plants would shut down due to old age and environmental laws. Now, new reports say in just 5 years, 25 Michigan generating units serving over 2 million people will have shut down. It takes 4 years to build plants to replace the electricity lost. We need to act now on a plan that puts Michigan first. If we don't act, D.C. will decide for us. Call your legislator now.
Now, these raise concerns about the closure of the 19 Michigan coal-fired power plants, which is happening. Are these spots are these spots in support of the two House bills, or can you help us understand what's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's the answer is yes and no. I think to some degree, it's basically saying let's get this done now, and trying to put pressure on the legislature to take action here in the month of December and try to make sure that the right policies are being developed. I don't know who specifically. There's a set of commercials that are being done by the utilities. There's a set of commercials being done by choice advocates and so forth. But I think the sense of these commercials is let's try to solve this problem here in Michigan, and let's try to put our Michigan touch on it. And that's the pressure. I think the fear that it almost tries to create is that, hey, you know, we're being forced to close these plants, and if we don't act now, there's danger ahead of us. And that's not true at all. You can talk to any of the utilities. They've been already planning these phase-outs of these coal power plants for years. There's a plan on how to replace them. Much of their plants have natural gas as the secondary place for it. So, you know, to me, I think it's just a point to try to put pressure on the legislature to resolve this and resolve it quickly. And I think we're ready to do that.
But where are the utilities? Where is Consumers and where is DTE on 4297 and 4298?
Well, I don't know where they are specifically on it. I would say that, you know, they've been, as I've had conversations with them, I think they've been pleased with what has come out of the committee. And really now the question is, a lot of times amendments will happen on the floor. And so depending on what those amendments are on the floor, I know there's a number of people who want to strengthen the choice language. I've got Democratic colleagues who want to take a look at a number of items, including more renewable energy language in there. And so I think depending on where that ends up, I think they'll have some they might continue supporting this, or they might have some concerns. But I think as of right now, my sense was as it came out of committee that they were okay with it, even though I think it pushed them on a number of issues like energy efficiency more so than they wanted to.
Will there be a significant debate or action on either of these before the end of the year, or will it be 2016 before we see anything?
Well, again, the 2008 law does come to a close to some degree at the end of this year, so there's been a push to try to get it done. We will for sure, I think, have it out of the House in some way or fashion. The question is how quickly does the Senate want to deal with this? They've been having hearings all spring and summer, so they might be ready to quickly react to our proposals, but they also might want to take some time and look at this in January or February. So it's really going to be, I think, on the Senate to see how quickly we get to resolution.
The approach Michigan and the country should take regarding more Syrian refugees has sparked disagreement. Governor Snyder called for a pause for Michigan, and other mostly Republican governors responded with similar kinds of cautionary measures. Where are you on this?
Well, I was surprised by the governor's response. You know, I've been very supportive of the governor's immigration policies to date. You know, so I was surprised to see him, you know, make a statement that didn't try to educate the public here in Michigan. As we know, taking in refugees is a very extensive process. It often takes anywhere from 2 to 3 years to get refugee status. And it's not only the country, the U.S. government involved in the Department of National Security, it's also the U.N. And so to so quickly dismiss the program and not realize that whatever he decided here was going to be part of a national narrative. And knowing that his party, especially led by, you know, Donald Trump in the debates, talking about wanting to register Muslims, that other people are talking about only accepting certain religious backgrounds of refugees, such as only Christians only, to somehow think that his decision to pause this would not be part of a national and international narrative, I think was naive on his part and the people that influence his decisions.
Sam Seng is the Democrat representing Michigan's 69th district, which includes East Lansing. We've been talking primarily about Michigan's energy future and the energy legislation currently in the House and the Senate, but about other measures as well. Sam, good to see you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Its current state coming up in Michigan and across the country, the employment rate for persons with disabilities far exceeds that of the general population. A new program in Michigan orders all state agencies to coordinate their policies to promote better employment access for persons with disabilities. We'll talk with two executives from local nonprofits working on the front lines to build a more integrated workplace for everyone. Also, after nearly 60 minutes of smash-mouth Big Ten football, it was Michael Geiger's toe that put away the Buckeyes on Saturday. Al Martin of Current Sports talks about MSU's huge win over Ohio State on Saturday. Well, of all the notable battles of the U.S. Civil War, none can match the carnage of Antietam. Soldiers and civilians from Michigan played crucial roles in the battle, linked by history to President Abraham Lincoln's issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation soon after. Current State Scott Pohl is here with the Michigan authors of a new book on Antietam. Who are these authors, Scott?
Well, Mark, our listeners know one of these two men, Jack Dempsey of the Michigan Historical Commission. He has led us on several tours of historic sites in Detroit for Current State. He's written Michigan at Antietam, the Wolverine State's Sacrifice on America's Bloodiest Day, with co-author Brian James Egan. They want more than for this story to be told. They're working on the erection of a monument to Michigan's contribution to the Battle of Antietam. Jack Dempsey and Brian James Egan, welcome to Current State.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
I wanted to begin with the phrase in the title, America's Bloodiest Day. Can you explain to our listeners who aren't up on their Civil War history the importance of Antietam and what you mean by America's Bloodiest Day?
Yes. Wednesday, September 17th, 1862, approximately 22,000 casualties occurred on a small hamlet or village of Sharpsburg, Maryland, right outside there. And it was the costliest day in American history with those number of casualties. And when we say a single day, it actually was about 13, 14 hours. It was within pretty much the daylight times that those number of casualties took place, virtually on American every single second. The result of the Battle of Antietam, it allowed Abraham Lincoln, permitted him to issue the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation and answered really the question of European intervention on the side of the Confederacy.
Jack, I want to hear from you on this. The book is about Michigan's role at Antietam. Can you give us an outline of the role that Michigan played here?
Years ago, I went to the Antietam battlefield, and I asked a park ranger, is there anything having to do with Michigan here? And his response was, not much. But as it turned out, based on Brian's years of experience and our research, there are many, many Michigan stories. And Michigan soldiers, Michigan officers, Michigan civilians were instrumental in the campaign, because this unfolded over several weeks in September of 1862, and in the battle itself and then its aftermath.
Let's maybe pick one of the Michigan personalities involved. Let's say, for instance, I know that George Custer was at Antietam.
George Custer, in this part of the war at this time, was a staff officer to the commanding general for the Union Army, which meant he would carry dispatches. He would help locate and position troops, really not part of his responsibilities to engage in actual combat. And what we were able to do with the aid of a researcher, a colleague of ours down in Washington, is actually find the original copies of dispatches that Custer sent back to headquarters, where he's talking about how he's at the front line. He's participating in combat. He's encouraging his superior officer to push forward and press the Confederates, because we can win a smashing victory if we would just hurry up and get to the point where we can muster all our forces. So it's a very interesting foretaste of Custer later in the war and, of course, after the war.
In many of his dispatches, he was supposed to take back to headquarters, and we found that a lot of them ended up back at headquarters when he sort of stayed on the front lines to participate himself, leading charges through Boonesboro, chasing the Confederate Army as they withdrew from South Mountain.
I'm not sure we've clarified for people that Custer was from Michigan, in case you're not aware of that, listeners, from, I believe, Monroe.
Correct. He was born in New Rumley, Ohio, but he made his home eventually in Monroe, married a local girl, Elizabeth Bacon, and he considered Monroe, Michigan, his hometown.
And the most imposing Custer monument statue is in downtown Monroe.
Correct.
We're talking with Brian James Egan and Jack Dempsey about Michigan at Antietam, the Wolverine State's sacrifice on America's bloodiest day. Brian, can you read me a passage from Michigan at Antietam?
Yes. This is from Julia Susan Wheelock. And she writes, "The 25th, I saw for the first time the wounded as they came from the battlefield, the bloody field of Antietam. They were taken to the Patton Office Hospital. Oh, those bloody, mangled forms will long be fresh in memory. Some were able, with the help of a comrade, to crawl up the stairs, while others were carried up on stretchers. A few moans were heard, but no complaining and no loud groaning, as I expected to hear."
Well, that certainly helps take us all to Antietam. Brian, thank you.
Thank you.
There was a note in the materials I've looked at about your book, fellows, about the role of Michigan soldiers and civilians at Antietam. And so I guess I wanted some clarification on what role civilians played at Antietam.
One of the most fascinating stories to me is the role played by someone named John J. Bagley. Years later, he became one of Michigan's governors. At the time, he was serving in a civilian capacity in what probably we would say today would be the Red Cross or the USO. He was acting for a committee that would funnel supplies that weren't furnished by the U.S. government, U.S. military, to the soldiers. So he would be close to the front to help funnel those supplies from Michigan citizens to their boys and men at the front line. And he actually was there at the battlefield and witnessed the aftermath, provided aid and comfort to soldiers who were wounded, who needed supplies, and then became part of the commission that created and developed the battlefield, which today is a national battlefield. He was Michigan's representative.
Brian James Egan, do you have other examples of civilians?
Back at the home front, so to speak, Michigan civilians had galvanized a lot of support. Just like today when we send care packages to soldiers at the front or overseas, wherever they may be deployed, that was the case in the 1860s. Early on, a lot of the Michigan civilians, of course, would support their family, their local citizenry, but the state of Michigan galvanized a larger effort, the Michigan Soldiers Aid Society, which would sort of consolidate all of these efforts throughout the state to make sure that supplies, items that the soldiers couldn't get from the military, the comforts, even medical supplies would get to the front lines. A lot of Michigan civilians were instrumental that early in the war, throughout the entire war, and so they had played a part of that as well.
Let's get back to soldiers from Michigan. I understand that at least one unit from Michigan suffered terrible casualties at Antietam.
Yes, the 7th Michigan Infantry went into the battle that morning with about 636 soldiers accounted for on the books, and within probably an hour and a half, more than half of them couldn't be accounted for. They had entered the famous West Woods near the Dunker Church in the hopes of driving the Confederates further off the field, and they were overwhelmed by Mississippians and some Georgians that were literally coming out of the ground, as some of the accounts said. They appeared out of nowhere, and in a very short time, nearly half of the numbers fell, and it contributed to the overall federal sort of defeat at that end of, or that phase of the battle.
The two of you have co-founded the Michigan Civil War Association, if I'm understanding it correctly, and that part of the mission of this new association is to see that an appropriate marker of some sort is erected at Antietam to note the contributions of people from Michigan there. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. Michigan does not have a monument on the Antietam National Battlefield. Why, we're not certain about that. They do. There are mentions of Michigan in the interpretive plaques, but they do not have a monument.
Do other states have a monument there?
Yes, most of the other states, even some Confederate states, have monuments at Antietam and other national parks as well. But at Antietam, Michigan is not represented by a monument, and we hope to correct that.
Michigan does have monuments at other Civil War battlefields, Gettysburg, Shiloh, Vicksburg, perhaps the most poignant one at Andersonville, where Michigan soldiers were imprisoned as POWs. But as Brian said, there's been no Michigan monument ever erected at Antietam, and we feel privileged and blessed to have been given the opportunity on the Michigan Historical Commission to lead the effort to erect the first ever monument for Michigan's participation in this campaign, which resulted in the Emancipation Proclamation.
So what exactly is being done to raise money for that effort?
One of the things is this book, which we co-wrote, which just appeared on August 31st. All the proceeds from our part of it are going to that effort. The Michigan Civil War Association is a 501c3. Tax-deductible donations can be made to it, and all of that money will be used to erecting the monument. And we hope to do that within, obviously, a number of months. It'll take a while to raise the money and get everything done, but hopefully in the near future.
Can you describe the monument you have in mind?
In working with the National Park Service, they helped determine the location, which Jack and I are completely thrilled with, the location where the 7th Michigan actually crossed a turnpike, a road, and entered the fray. And we hope to keep it within the scale and scope of other monuments of that level throughout the battlefield. So we're hoping it consists of marble or stone, granite. We hope to have a bronze life-size figure on the top, more or less representing Colonel Norman Hall, who was leading the 7th Michigan. But since this is our one opportunity to represent Michigan, it will be a monument to all Michigan units that participated during the battle. However, it will be located where the 7th Michigan actually fought.
Jack Dempsey and Brian James Egan are the co-authors of Michigan at Antietam, the Wolverine State's Sacrifice on America's Bloodiest Day. Jack Dempsey and Brian James Egan, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And the music is, of course, A Shokin Farewell by Jay Unger. heard extensively in the Ken Burns documentary, The Civil War, even though it does not date back to the U.S. Civil War. Unger wrote the piece in 1982. Coming up on Current State, the Snyder administration is calling on all state agencies to coordinate their efforts to improve job access for persons with disabilities. We'll talk about the Employment First program with two local nonprofit executives who work to build that workplace culture for persons with disabilities. Plus, the field goal so nice he made it twice, Michael Geiger's biggest ever kick. Plus, how the Spartans pulled off a stunning win without star quarterback Connor Cook. That and more after the break on Current State. Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're with you three times daily, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. on 90.5 FM and at noon on AM 870. We're always at WKAR.org. Last week, Michigan Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly signed an executive order intended to increase job opportunities for persons with disabilities. The Employment First Initiative calls on all state departments and agencies to ensure their policies promote competitive employment opportunities. A main goal of the program is to improve support services for persons with disabilities in the workplace. Joining me now to talk about the effort is Todd Culver. Todd's the executive director of MARO, which stands for Michigan Association of Rehabilitation Organizations. Welcome.
Thank you, Mark.
Also with us today, Mitch Tomlinson, president and CEO of Peckham Incorporated. The nonprofit organization is well known in the Lansing area for providing job training for workers with disabilities. Mitch, welcome to Current State.
Good morning, Mark.
Todd, before we get into the specifics of Employment First, tell us a little bit about MARO. What do you try to get done at MARO?
Sure. MARO is a statewide network of mission-driven organizations that support individuals with disabilities and other barriers in their pursuit of access to the community. That access could mean employment, transportation, housing, or even recreation in the arts.
And Employment First is the name given to this program here in Michigan, but it's really part of a national movement, I'm told, to bring persons with disabilities into a competitive and integrated work environment. Competitive and integrated. What does that mean?
Well, first of all, it recognizes the value of work beyond economic self-sufficiency and independence, but also the dignity and self-esteem that can come with a job well done. But to the terms that are used in the executive order, competitive means at or above minimum wage, and in an integrated setting means side-by-side along individuals without disabilities.
And Mitch Tomlinson, is there a strict definition of disability?
You know, and the federal government has 80-some different definitions of disability. So this is the definition. This one is just one of those definitions. And certainly federal programs all require different definitions for different following of the law.
Well, talk to us about the people you train at Peckham. Do they all have a physical or cognitive disability then?
You know, Peckham's a private nonprofit company that kind of blends human services and employment together. So we believe that we're the largest employer of folks with disabilities in the state of Michigan. So ask me your question again.
Do most of your employees at Peckham have some kind of physical or cognitive disability?
Sure. So about 80% of the direct labor on projects that we operate at Peckham are folks with significant disability, yes.
There was a report issued a little over a year ago by the Michigan Protection and Advocacy Service, Wayne State University, and the Michigan Developmental Disabilities Council, and it noted that many vocational rehabilitation service providers, and I will quote, fail to provide adequate training that results in meaningful community-based employment. As a result, many Michiganders with disabilities who are employed are perpetually limited to work in sheltered workshops that segregate individuals with disabilities from individuals without disabilities. I'd like to ask both of you, what is it going to take to bring your clients to a full integration scenario, which is apparently the goal here?
It's part of why we support this initiative, Mark, is that it establishes a higher bar and raises expectations that folks with disabilities can work in the community at a competitive wage in an integrative setting. And we're always looking for opportunities to improve, certainly. But we're in an unprecedented time of progress in that area. We can focus on the negative statistics, or we can look forward and talk about how our economy is improving, about how this executive order establishes a framework consistent with federal policy that really establishes that expectation that community-based, competitive, integrated employment is going to be the optimal outcome. And we're very grateful for the support that we have from the executive office, and in particular, Lieutenant Governor Calley.
What kinds of responses are you getting from your members?
Very supportive. In fact, our board of directors endorsed an Employment First policy nearly 2 years ago. This is a direction that we've recognized in the regulatory landscape and a direction that we want to pursue as a membership.
But they're supportive, but do they consider it attainable? It's possible in their view? I'm trying to get at how big a lift this is going to be.
Absolutely. I believe it is possible. We've seen the possible achieved every day in the workplaces around the state for individuals with disabilities, and this codifies that expectation, and we expect further progress.
Mitch Tomlinson, what do you think? How big a lift is that going to be at Peckham?
You know, we're excited about this executive order and certainly excited about the governor and the lieutenant governor's support for inclusion and integration for folks with disabilities. You know, at Peckham, we're working every day to make sure that folks with significant disabilities are integrated in the work labor market. So, you know, for us, I don't think this is a huge lift at all. You know, we're providing skilled training in five different job areas and competitive employment for folks with disabilities every day. You know, we believe strongly in the dignity of work and including people with disabilities into the work setting. You know, we know that people with disabilities are disproportionately unemployed in the labor market. And I think this is just a strong statement from the governor that says we need to push for folks with disabilities to be included in the labor market. So everything we do at Peckham is geared at that every day.
What about the pay piece? What about the salary piece, though? I mean, if there is pressure to raise salaries for this segment of the workforce, how much pressure does that put on a Peckham or on other members of your organization, Todd?
I think it puts a positive pressure in support of an initiative that we've been pursuing all along, which is the highest level of independence and self-sufficiency, which means the highest economic benefit to the individual worker.
You know, Peckham, we've created 2,000 jobs in the state of Michigan for folks with significant disabilities. All of them are at minimum wage or better. So for us, paying commensurate wages, paying wages significant to the worker is what we do every day.
We're talking about the new Employment First program. It's meant to increase job opportunities for persons with disabilities here in Michigan. Our guests are Mitch Tomlinson, President and CEO of Peckham Incorporated in Lansing. Also, Todd Culver is the Executive Director of MARO, the Michigan Association of Rehabilitation Organizations. Now, the report I referred to earlier, Michigan Protection and Advocacy Service, Wayne State, Michigan Developmental Disabilities Council, that was written September of 2014, it stated that 81% of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities were unemployed versus 9% of people without disabilities. There's a huge disparity here. Is that gap shrinking at all? What do you have to say about that?
Well, we feel like this initiative, this executive order, and some of the federal regulatory initiatives like the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act and the Home and Community-Based Services regulations all are blending to support this movement upward. And certainly there's a gap between individuals with and without disabilities, both in labor force participation and in the unemployment rate. But anything that we can do to narrow that gap and enhance opportunities for individuals with disabilities, and we think this executive order does that, is a good thing.
What barriers do persons with disabilities face that are unrelated to their actual disabilities? And I guess I'm getting at discrimination here. How big an issue is that?
Well, stigma remains an issue in our culture and in our society. We've found in some studies, I believe, have supported that When an individual has a personal connection to another person with a disability, then that can help lower that stigma or potential for discrimination. And we feel that raising this level of inclusion, whether it be in the workforce or other areas of community access, can address that in a substantive way.
Is discrimination some kind of issue at Peckham, Mitch?
You know, I think there's a growing understanding that folks with disabilities should be included in the labor market, and that your employment setting is a richer, more successful labor market if you employ people with disabilities. So sure, I think oftentimes folks with disabilities don't get the same opportunity for competitive employment as others. Certainly at Peckham, we reverse that. So we favor folks with disabilities because that's our mission for one thing, but we also have come to understand that that labor force is every bit as capable of competing in the labor market if given the proper supports. Mm. So we really focus at Peckham on support services, helping them with issues of transportation and childcare and independent living so that we can support their success in the labor market.
And I think that's the message from this executive order and some other disability employment initiatives that have occurred in the state, including the recent My Hidden Talent Tour hosted by Lieutenant Governor Calley and Justice Bernstein, that there are hidden talents that we as service providers can do a better job of discovering, and that we can encourage businesses through better engagement techniques to find the match with those hidden talents and the value that that provides for the employer.
Mitch, I'm curious, what happens once your clients leave Peckham? Do you track their next level of employment, their success?
Yeah, sure. At Peckham, we have 30 different distinct rehabilitation programs, so each one have different entrance and exit criteria. We believe that people should have the choice, so certainly people at Peckham that choose to stay and work in our work, in our social enterprise model, can stay and work. If they want to choose to go and work for a competitive employer, we're going to embrace that and help support that in every way we can. So we track that continually, but it varies program to program.
We've been talking about a new initiative here in Michigan to help persons with disabilities gain better access to the workforce. It's called Employment First. Mitch Tomlinson is president and CEO of Peckham Incorporated in Lansing, a leading job skills provider for the disability community. And Todd Culver is executive director of MARO, the Michigan Association of Rehabilitation Organizations. Thank you for your insights. Good luck.
Thank you for having us, Mark.
Great. Thanks.
Well, as MSU fans looked ahead to this year's showdown with the favored Buckeyes at Ohio Stadium, who could have imagined Coach Mark D'Antonio's backup quarterback shuffle strategy would lead to a stunning Spartans victory? With us now, WKAR current sports host Al Martin. How are you?
How you doing, Mark? I tell you what, you didn't hear that O-H-I-O chant after that, the aftermath of that game on Saturday, huh?
What about this game plan? Did anyone see this game plan coming, or was the general thought that Connor Cook would be able to lead the team on Saturday?
No one saw this coming, Mark. And we even asked Coach D and Connor the days leading up to this game on Saturday last week whether or not Connor Cook was healthy enough to go. Now, after the injury last week, as I came on with you, we chatted about how Coach D'Antonio took the presser and said that, hey, he's pretty confident that Cook will be fine. On a scale from 1 to 10, he even gave us a 9.5, to be exact. And leading up to the game against Ohio State on Saturday, I mean, all signs pointed to Connor Cook being healthy. So it was a shock to everyone, that Connor Cook was not able to go against Ohio State literally minutes before that game on Saturday, Mark.
And what did you make of how O'Connor and Terry got it done against Ohio State?
No one saw this coming. Again, there were two aspects to that game, Mark, that no one foresaw. That being one, as you mentioned, Connor Cook being injured for that game and not getting that start. And number two was the weather, which I'll get to in just a sec. But It's really crazy because when you evaluate that matchup against Ohio State, this would happen now, right? The biggest game all year. You've had injuries all season. Michigan State has been bitten by the injury bug all year. And then when you play the defending national champs on the road in Columbus, Ohio, the first time since 2011, your quarterback, the only man who has been consistent for this team all season, is the one injured. Is that next man mentality, though, that D'Antonio has been preaching all season. O'Connor and Terry didn't have to be lights out when it comes to their arm in this one, Mark. And frankly, they couldn't. You know, I mentioned the weather. No one saw that it was going to be cold and rainy. Yeah. You saw a lot of conservative play calling. And really, the premise of Michigan State's offense had to be running the ball with guys like Holmes and Scott on the ground. And even with O'Connor and Terry, who picked up some big yards when they needed to.
Current Sports' Al Martin is our guest. We're revisiting the victory over Ohio State on Saturday and probably looking ahead to Penn State here before the segment is through. The Buckeyes went into the game favored by, I want to say, 13 points is where the line stood on, mm-hmm. on Friday at least. Where did they fall short? How did they not get it done?
Well, a lot of it has to do with Michigan State dominating, I think, on both sides of the line. Michigan State's defensive line, they were able to slow down and put a lot of pressure on JT Barrett and Ezekiel Elliott. Actually, when looking at the total yards of production from Ohio State, period, it was 132. That is the lowest total yardage in the Urban Meyer era or history. It was unbelievable what they were able to do. Now, it helped that it was, again, cold and rainy outside, but they did a remarkable job of slowing down Mark Ezekiel Elliott, was a Heisman Trophy candidate. Mm-hmm. That takes a lot to slow him down. I really have to give a shout-out. A guy who really stood out to me when it comes to that defensive line was Craig Evans. I thought him, you know, being in, you know, on that line, he was able to cause a lot of havoc. Also, on the offensive line, Mark, you know, the running game becomes more imminent in a game like that because you can't rely on big bombs down the field because of the weather again. Mm-hmm. So having guys like Holmes and L.J. Scott, you got to get the ball to those guys, but you have to have a good offensive line to open holes, and that offensive line did that throughout that entire game.
I enjoyed watching L.J. Scott a lot.
He's great, isn't he?
He's a true freshman, too. So
and he didn't turn the ball over. That was the biggest bugaboo of his the past 2 weeks.
This team doesn't make a whole lot of mistakes.
No,
that's the other thing that game after game, at some point in every game, I will make that remark to whoever is watching the game with me. This team just doesn't screw up.
And they had one, though, if you remember, on the one moment through that game, a punt reception, and McGarrett King's just, with the conditions, he muffed the punt reception. And that's really how Ohio State was only able to score twice in that game off of turnovers. Damian Terry fumbled. It gave Ohio State a short, field. They scored there.
True.
And then McGarrett King gives them, 6 yards to the end zone, and they score there.
After the game, some Buckeye players criticized their coaches, play calling. Any validity to those comments?
I think there is. But, I'm privy to the old statement, Mark, that you got to keep it in-house. Don't air it out to the press. And the man that everyone's talking about today and that they were talking about after that game was Ezekiel Elliott. I actually watched his raw presser after that game, and he called out the coaching staff. He called out Urban Meyer's play calling. He thought it was too conservative. He felt as though he should have gotten the ball more. And he felt as though that, the coaching staff, quote, didn't put us in a position to win the game. You don't make that statement after a game like that. I think Ezekiel Elliott, I think maybe now, given a few days to think about it, I've given 2 days to think about what he said, if he could have it back, I don't think he would have made those statements, Mark.
We got less than a minute, but after this big win, MSU maintains control of its destiny. How does Penn State match up against the Spartans? I know they fell to Michigan on Saturday.
Yeah, they did, but you can't sleep on Christian Hackenberg, who is a clear NFL quarterback right now. He's a guy who can burn you downfield. If Michigan State secondary, if they come ready to play, and if we see a secondary that we saw against Maryland, if we see a defense that we saw against Ohio State, I think Michigan State wins this game by double digits. But the sea is now parted now, Mark. Michigan State, as you stated, they control their own fate. They beat Penn State. They play in the Big Ten Championship game, in which it fathoms that they'll play Iowa. They beat Iowa. It's hard not to put MSU in that playoff.
Al Martin is the host of Current Sports on WKAR Radio and TV. Thanks, Al.
Thank you, Mark.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, two Ingham County IT officials recently have been removed from their positions for accepting tickets to sports events and other perks from county vendors. We'll hear the thoughts of Board of Commissioners Chairman Brian McGrain. We'll also learn about what lies ahead for the Ingham Health Plan in Ingham County. Plus, the Children's Ballet Theater of Michigan is celebrating its 35th anniversary of putting on the Nutcracker here in mid-Michigan. We'll speak with the director and choreographer ahead of its Wharton Center performances coming up this weekend. All that and more Tuesday on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks as well to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, Drew Hill, and Al Martin. We're also a podcast. Get the latest Current State delivered straight to your smartphone. Every day, just subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever quality podcasts are accessible. Social media. Find us on Twitter at KAR Current State, on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. We'll see you Tuesday on Current State. Thank you.